Hello there, one and all. He's Ralph, I'm Peter, and we're here again with another edition of our weekly chat. This week, we're going to talk about two topics. Firstly, the effect that the Houthi rebels are having on global inflation, and secondly, the divergence of fortunes within the luxury goods sector. So with regard to the first topic, obviously, we know that there's conflict in the Middle East. The emergence of the Houthi rebels creating havoc within the Red Sea has essentially meant that shipments going from Asia through to Europe have been severely disrupted for the most part. And it means that these ships are going to have to go via the Cape of Good Hope, which adds anything between 7 and 20 days onto a voyage. That clearly has massive cost implications as well. There's been loads of talk about it over the last few weeks. I just thought it'd be very interesting to know what Ralph's thoughts on this are. So what do you reckon?
This would indeed be very interesting to know, even for me, because it's a relatively new topic. Well, inflation isn't. We have been talking about inflation ad nauseam in past shows, but inflation is just really the topic that doesn't go away, isn't it? So what we have here now is a potentially fresh impetus to keep inflation higher for longer, or to drive inflation back up. But let me maybe first of all establish a more joyous framework, because inflation, having increased, as we all know, jumped up, exploded indeed in the wake of the Ukraine war. Inflation has since then steadily been falling, and be it to the credit of our government or the credit of the Bank of England or to the credit of consumers who basically stayed at home, not spending a lot of money they did no longer have. It is true that inflation has been falling to a point where now voices are starting to call for a commensurate reduction in interest rates, because clearly that is what we wish to achieve. Interest rates have been increased in order to combat inflation. Now inflation is coming down, so you would think, well, there we are, you know, we've achieved what we wanted. Now interest rates can come down. It is not quite the case yet. We are not quite there yet. The ECB has kept interest rates where they are just this week. And it appears as if the central banks and decision makers of this world are not quite ready yet to allow interest rates to come down and commensurately pass on the benefit of that to consumers in the form of reduced household costs. And this is sort of the context which we are also needing to establish when we talk about the Houthis and the potential impact of their activities, because it is precisely the expectations for interest rates to come down, which are appearing to sort of hang finely in the balance at the moment. It is always difficult for central banks to decide at what point precisely to follow on with any kind of interest rate related policy action. But currently, central banks are in the decision spot where they have to decide, are we going to lower interest rates now or wait for a while? Allowing for the trends to manifest themselves. Is inflation going to come down further, or is it halting and perhaps even coming back up? And that is, of course, exactly the context. So we need to now examine external impacts on inflation and see whether we means a central bank, are now happy to believe that inflation is going to come down further. And in this context, unfortunately, we have to say that the military or militant activity of the Houthis in South Yemen is potentially lending a fresh impact on inflation, which is going to at least halt the further decline of inflation and potentially increase it. And of course, just to establish that we're all on the same page, we all know what's going on, the Houthis in South Yemen are, flippantly speaking, lobbing bombs at passing ships, and that's not a good thing because these ships are containing freight, which we need, and this freight is normally carried on cargo ships which are going through the Gulf and the Suez Canal. And as you said, if that is no longer possible for the moment because of the increased risk, then these ships are being diverted through the much longer route around the Cape of Good Hope. That adds not just time to market, it adds costs to the it adds costs to basically everything which is on the ship. So we are always focusing, I believe, in the first instance on the cost of oil as a casualty of the Middle Eastern situation. But of course, the potential costs are much wider than that, and they're impacting any kind of consumer goods and any kind of raw material which is currently carried via shipping routes. Mm-hmm. And that is why the impact or the potential impact, let's call it first potential impact, and we're going to come back to that in a second. The potential impact of the Houthis military activity there, that is the reason why it is potentially so much of an issue, because it will increase the cost of pretty much any kind of good. And second, of course, disrupt supply chains. And supply chain interruptions, have we not heard that before? That was exactly what happened with the Ukraine war, and we know what happened in the aftermath of that. Inflation went up, interest rates went up to combat inflation. So I said just a second ago, potentially, the Houthis activities are potentially going to increase rates. Let's just test whether that is the case. Is it potentially going to happen, or has it already happened? And the source which I'm going to turn to, literally, I'm turning my head away to actually look at the chart, which is is on my screen here, is the Global and Shanghai Export Containerized Freight Index, which is always a good chart to turn to in times of need, I find. And so
I'm surprised that, you know, not everyone, you know, turns to it in times of need, right?
I believe that is absolutely true, and my surprise is aligned with yours. I look at it quite regularly. I don't know about you, but at least once a week I have a little glimpse at the freight index.
Nice.
Freight, not fright.
Yes.
Anyway, so and here we are. So joking aside, I'm just going to read out some numbers to you guys. So this is now we are now on the chart in the year 2020, and that's pretty much when the Ukraine war started. And my base number here is about 1,000. These are index numbers, of course, so they're dimensionless. That's just a number. So we are at 1,000 in 2020, and just after that, about a month, 2 months after that, in the wake of Putin invading the Ukraine, the index jumped from that level of 1,000 to 3,500. We have two indices here. I'm not going to bore you with the details. I mean, that's basically it. So 3,500. And that is right at the end of the two-year period. Now we are 2022. So just for those who are not looking at the chart now for some unexplained reason, we are in 2020, the index is at 1,000. 2 years later, showing the impact of the Ukraine war, we are at 3,500. So that is the sort of steep increase which we have here. And then, interestingly enough, we are moving towards sort of the end of 23, the middle of 23, and the index has just crashed down again from that level of maximum elevation from 3,300 to about 1,000. So not quite, but almost the level from where we started. It is a straight line up and a straight line down. Now, very recently, starting in January this year, the index has left this base of 1,000 and has jumped right back up to 2,200. So just the numbers again, 1,000 to 3,300, back down to 1,000, back up to 1,400. So a very steep increase, but not to the same level as the one we've seen before. The question is now, is it going to attain that level again, or is it not? The one thing which we already know for sure, because it has happened, is the rapid increase. The sort of first derivative, it jumped right back up, and we've seen that. So when I said potential before, I deliberately questioned that word. Is it potential? Is it about to happen? No, we are sure it has happened. And there is therefore a clear impact of the Houthi military activity on the cost of freights. I can't really see this on the chart here, but it appears as if there is a little bit of a kink downwards again. And the question therefore on people's minds is now, how severe is this type of disruption? Is it as severe as the Ukraine war, in which case the level of freight index, freight cost, is going to rise further from here? Or is it more contained, in which case we've seen the increase and now it's going to remain at levels of this nature and then perhaps come down gradually? I'm almost inclined to leave you guys to decide, because I haven't got the crystal ball here. I would suggest that perhaps we have seen the height already, because shipping transfer, if you just look at traffic of shipping, has, this was astounding to me, come down to near zero in January. So in other words, if this rapid increase in the freight index to levels of 1,500 is indeed a direct response to the disruptive activity of the Houthis on shipping traffic, then shipping traffic having come down to zero, we can't go down to negative numbers. So you would think that perhaps the level which we've seen here is already the level at which this is going to come to an end. But the second part of this is, of course, we've talked about the Ukraine impact. It went straight up and then it went straight down. So that last bit, level which we can expect from here, I'm sort of guessing that it will plateau a little bit and remain at this level, meaning that the now increased higher freight costs are going to have more time to trickle down into the economy and increase inflation in the next several months to come. So what I would expect from this crisis is therefore to say that any hopeful expectations that interest rates will be lowered by central banks in response of reducing inflation are probably going to have to cool a little bit. And it looks to me as if we are here for inflation at around current levels for longer. It is not that I'm expecting inflation to rise rapidly from here necessarily, but I would not expect interest rates to come down perhaps in the next few months. And this is all going to be a function of continued military activity in the Middle East and where we're going from there. As always, we are in an area of developing dynamics driven by geopolitical developments, which nobody can foresee, nobody can forecast quite clearly. So that's perhaps where I should stop speaking then. But we all need to have an eye on geopolitical developments in the Middle East in order to gauge what we kind of expect interest rates in the end to go. But that's what we're really interested in. We're interested in interest rates coming down, not just in inflation coming down.
I mean, I'd add a few things there. So one thing I read recently, which I don't know why I wasn't able to mention in Watson's Daily, because it might have been right at the end of the week or something, and it didn't get into the edition. But I've read somewhere about how Chinese freight, you know, it's not tankers, but, you know, ships are actually going through there. And they're kind of being given safe or safer passage to go through, which I think is interesting, because if that is the case, that might actually limit the, you know, overall prices going up, because actually freight can get through. But what that will affect is the freight operators. So if you've got Chinese operators, suddenly they're going to get loads of business, whereas maybe some of the Western ones aren't, because they're not going to be used. Say Western ones, I mean, Japanese ones are the same as well. They're not going by that route either. So I thought that was one interesting thing. The other thing as well is that generally with regard to the oil price and the effect on the oil price, you know, conventional wisdom would be in wars, oil prices go up, right? But the other thing to remember here is, again, this is something that was, I think it was said by the IEA, the International Energy Agency, that actually oil production from non-OPEC countries is set to rise significantly this year. So they were talking about that in the context of oil prices going up because of OPEC cuts in production. But actually, you could apply that to the effect of the you know, the conflict in the Middle East. You could say that as well. You could say that maybe the increased production of non-OPEC countries, that's not just the US, by the way, it's lots of other countries as well, but the US is the biggest one, then that would mean that may take some of the edge off that as well. So in other words, there are a couple of factors that may help to limit the you know, freight prices and oil prices may limit how far up they go. But anyway, I just thought that was also worth mentioning.
Yeah, that's very interesting, especially the point you're making on Chinese freight companies. Yeah, I don't really know how to interpret this in the end. I'm vaguely surprised that the Houthis are capable of making this type of clinical separation between a Chinese freighter and a non-Chinese freighter, but clearly they have this capacity. I don't believe we should think of these guys as somehow poorly organized or poorly equipped, because clearly they're not. But it is, yes, so first point is, yes, absolutely, you're right. I mean, this should sort of mean that Chinese freight companies are going to attract more business. But then, of course, the products and goods and raw materials which are on these ships are destined often for the European market. I mean, the Chinese economy is, the biggest producer of consumer goods in the world, but clearly the customers are the US and the European markets. And so it is good news, either way. You know, the Chinese freighting companies might benefit directly, but consumers in Europe and the US will benefit from it, because some of the kit we are buying is on these ships. And the second point, oil price. Yeah, oil price is always a difficult one for me to gauge, to be honest with you. I mean, most of the oil exporting economies are in the Middle East. The US is the biggest, and if not the biggest, then the second biggest global producer of oil, but most of that is consumed in the domestic market of the US. So they're not very big in terms of the export of oil, which, however, in the end is all interlinked. So your comments are well taken. This may well put a lid on where these prices are going to go.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have thought they'd still go up. It just might limit how far up they go. That's all, you know. So,
yeah.
Because there'll be that perception, even if it's not the reality. The perception that it will do can sometimes be enough to limit the upside as well. So anyway, okay. Well, look, we'll move on to the second topic of today, which is the divergence of fortunes within the luxury goods sector. Now, I suppose we've
some of them will be on these ships.
That's correct. That is correct. I mean, I think it would be fair to say the last, up until probably the last, maybe the end of the third quarter, perhaps, of last year, I'd say that that luxury goods had been doing really well. You know, there'd been all this stuff about revenge spending after after lockdowns, particularly in China, because of course China was locked down for longer than most places. But you know, then you've got the uptick of travel, so more travelers going around the world shopping, and I suppose, you know, a lot of those would be relatively well off people traveling, because So they would have been going around spending loads of money. But it does seem that over the last quarter or so, the luxury goods theme has been tailing off a bit, or showing signs of tailing off. Now, there was an interesting article this week where I was talking about how there may be a sort of a two-tier luxury goods sector, in that you've got a top tier, which is very high-end, you know, goods, and then you've got a top middle, if you like, or upper middle, which is still aspirational for most people, but just not at the top level. So, for instance, I would say things like, probably in terms of cars, you're probably looking at something like Rolls-Royce, Bentley, Ferrari, Aston Martin, say being in the top tier of people of providing products that only people that really are extremely, you know, well off will be able to afford. Because even I think that the cheapest Aston, you know, is probably going to set you back $140,000, you know, before you've put any cup holders in it. you know, Ferrari maybe 160, 180, and then, you know, Bentley sort of around, yeah, you know, all those kinds of, and then, you know, the Rolls Royce and stuff, it higher still. So you've got those. We'll do it in terms of car companies momentarily. So those are examples of car companies. Underneath that, the top middle would be, I would say, you know, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and probably Porsche towards the top end of that. Because so for most people, I'd say Porsches would be very, you know, maybe aspirational, or certainly a sign that you've got a decent amount of money. But even then, you can get a Porsche for probably around 50,000. I mean, that would be, you know, that would be plastic everything, no cup holders, and a like a miniature screen or something, but still, you could still do it for like 50 grand or something, whereas, and that's their entry level. So that kind of puts them, they've got a broader range of price points, because of course they do have top end, you know, Porsches, which are very expensive, but they are very few and far between. So I think that their, you know, their meat and potatoes, as it were, is lower down. And I think that the same is true of, you know, Mercedes-Benz and BMW, and they're even further, you know, they're further down the scale. But anyway, so anyway, the argument is the high end is going to do really well, is going to continue to do really well, because the ultra high net worths are going to continue to spend, but the ones who are the sort of upper middle, not so much. In terms of luxury goods companies themselves, we've seen mixed performances. So you've got LVMH. I'd say LVMH is probably at the at the top end.
Yes,
I'd say Prada, and that's had that's been a bit mixed. But then you could say there are so many brands within LVMH that maybe it's muddy waters a bit, perhaps. But you know, Prada has done extremely well. And we've also got, I think Richemont as well has done really well. So, you know, top end stuff, all good. I would say middle is going to be something like Mulberry. Again, a lot of people listening to this will think, well, Mulberry handbags are really expensive. Yes, they are. But if you're talking about the world of luxury as a whole, it's not going to be at the top. So I think that there is an argument that there's a bit of a divergence between the top end and the top middle, you know, the top middle, if you like, because the high net worths are still going to be fine. The ones that are going to possibly be more affected are the ones at the upper end of the mid tier, if you see what I mean. But anyway, what do you think about that, Ralph?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I think the automotive sector is a very good sector just to use as a gauging tool of how the luxury sector, the luxury goods sector actually works in general. Because it's always difficult to sort of find words for this. If I was a retail analyst, I'm sure I'd be in, you know, I'd have all these words at my fingertips. I'm sure these categories exist, but I'm not. And so to your point, the automotive sector is very good to basically gauge or find or formulate a gauging tool for yourself of where these various segments in the luxury goods sector are situated. And you are right, there is a sort of top tier segment in the automotive goods sector, and we all know who they are. These are like Ferrari, Lamborghini, and then yes, Rolls Royce and Bentley and Aston Martin and all these kind of cars, McLaren, etc. Basically, cars, well, if it's a Rolls Royce, if you own one, you better you better employ a chauffeur too.
Okay. I was wondering what you're going to say there, but yeah.
Own a slave, yeah.
Yeah.
Then that's sedan chairs where you get carried around by lots of people, which very few people do in Europe. So, yes, Rolls Royces, if you own one, you better employ a chauffeur. If you own a Ferrari, it's almost impossible to live with one because it's a pure luxury item. So not only are you set back lots of money, you can only not really use it in everyday traffic. So the chances are you own some other car. So people of that nature really are high net worth individuals. These companies like Ferrari, etc., do play in this price bracket of 150K upwards. Porsche is a company which has deliberately chosen the strategy to target a broader market appeal. So they also play in that high segment of 150K, perhaps upwards, perhaps up to 200K, that sort of ballpark. But they come right down to levels of 50K, which is not cheap for a car, but let's face it, that's a lot more affordable for people to own. And the £150,000 cars in a Porsche, these really are, again, then cars which are comparable to Ferraris, Porsche 911 RS GT or something. Again, cars which you can't live with. They're just absurd. And,
and the way you described it before this call was very amusing, but I think you said you can't say that on this podcast.
I can sanitize it a little bit.
Yes, okay.
This Porsche 911, I had like a Porsche 911 racing model with a what do you call these things? A roll cage. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. You couldn't sit in it properly because it was hard as nails, and then everything, every uneven surface in the road would give you a hernia, basically. frankly. And I really don't understand why people own these cars. I didn't own them, as I said to you guys before. I once was member of a car club, and so I had access to these cars, but I didn't buy them. Yeah. I wouldn't buy them. I find them very difficult to live with. Anyway, that's all beside the point.
Yeah.
The point is that we're talking about the automotive sector just as a gauging tool to understand where the luxury goods sector is sort of separated. And Porsche covers all of the range. Then there are Ferraris, et cetera, which are in the top range. BMW is similar to Porsche, but a bit lower down, shifted down. I don't think they have similar sort of expensive cars. Mercedes do to an extent. So that is where these guys are sitting. So if you now look at the sort of people who buy this, and this is, of course, where we what we want to talk about. We are commenting on the perceived dynamic in the luxury good markets of separation. Or decoupling. There is the upper tier in the luxury good markets, which is decoupling in terms of growth currently from the, let's call it, middle tier. And so if I were to translate this into the Porsche metaphor, this means that the upper end of the scale models Porsche is selling, which are competing with Ferraris and such like, they are still growing. But the £50,000 market models, they are growing less, they are stalling a little bit. Back in the land of handbags and such like, we're talking LVMH, etc. It has been perceived that LVMH's growth is now stalling a little bit, but my first comment on this would be that's against a very potent growth delivery in last year indeed. I think in the Q4 fourth quarter, they had 10% growth, Q on Q, quarter on quarter. These are all jargon words for my time as an analyst, which is very high growth indeed and very difficult to beat. So you're establishing a very high base in terms of growth. Any commentary which would suggest that LVMH is slowing down versus that is a little bitter. But what is interesting to find is that this type of entire luxury goods bracket where LVMH is, where Gucci is, Armani, and the Prada to some extent, although they are more than Porsche, there are some entry models, Prada trainers, which even I can afford, these type of things, they are decoupling from the middle ground of luxury goods, which is Mulberry, again, very expensive, very good quality, but not in the very upper echelon of these luxury goods. And the question we were asking ourselves is, well, we can see this now, but why is this exactly? What is driving this growth or these growth dynamics? And I think we're both agreeing that there is a very odd dynamic when we you mentioned a very nice word for that, which you call it revenge buying, and that is sort of what's happening. It's almost like, you know, the dire days are over, the world is open again, let's spend our wonga and let's go out into the street and have a party, defined as buy a handbag,
I'll show them
I'll show the world exactly.
Yeah.
And this is what lots of people were doing. But now let's pause a little bit. Lots of people, meaning who? This is basically now everybody. This is middle incomes, higher incomes, and high net worth individuals. And the middle incomes were just running out of steam more quickly than the higher net worth individuals. No prizes for guessing. This is pretty much intuitive and obvious that this would happen. And I think we're seeing the impact now, let's say two-ish years after the after the end of the COVID crisis. The middle incomes have sort of packed up and are saving up the money to pay the mortgage bill and electricity costs. The wealthy are still buying, but perhaps they're buying Mulberry now. And the high net worth individuals, well, they are basically insulated against this anyway because they don't really care. They have tens and hundreds of millions of pounds worth of household wealth. And measured against that sort of order of magnitude, of course, £150,000 for a car is pocket money. And that is the reason I believe that the upper levels of luxury is A, still growing, and B, has remained very stable even through the COVID and after the COVID years, whereas the middle tiers of the luxury sector are now decoupling as the supporting growth dynamic are running out of steam in that particular subsegment.
I mean, I think, you know, another thing to consider there would be China recovery. You know, that's a bit, that's a major thing, because then that means more sales domestically in China, but also more travelers going to spend money outside China. So that's, I think, you know, I think that's one thing. But then another thing would be the overall, you know, interest rates coming down, and then that freeing up more cash for more people, which then starts the upper middle sort of getting back, you know, getting back again into the swing of spending. So yes, I mean, by the way things look at the moment, it looks like there's a bit of a pause for breath for the upper middle. But the high net, you know, the high end is still going to be fine.
Yeah.
As they always are.
By the way, I do not own a handbag. I don't know about you. Do you have a handbag?
I do not have a handbag, no.
Do you go out and buy expensive trainers and such like?
Not really.
What's your consumption profile like?
I think the most I've ever spent on a pair of trainers is 130 quid, I think. That's the most I've ever spent on them. What about you then?
Oh, I didn't want to make this about me. I was just interested. Just saying that I don't have a handbag. No. I recently did buy a nice pair of Jimmy Choo.
Oh, right. Okay.
Shoes. Let's call them shoes. Jimmy Choo has now expanded.
What do you mean, let's call them shoes? I mean, they are shoes, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's what
they are. But it's like actually very difficult to define what they are exactly. I mean, they have recently had a collaboration with Timberland, who is, of course, a proper walking boots company. And so they are now sort of, it's almost like the equivalent of SUV. You know, they're producing these shoes. They look like walking shoes, but they are not really walking shoes. I mean, if I use them on a hike in Austria, they just basically fall apart after two days. So they look like walking shoes, but they're clearly just to prance about in an urban setting. But they look very cool. And that is that's back to the land of luxury goods. That's the sort of thing. Yeah. And I'm sure people are still buying that because it's at a lower price point than the sort of weird Nike trainers for £5,000, whatever, which now also exist.
I will say that when we next meet, I definitely want to see you with these, you know, these Jimmy Choo Timberland shoes or
deal.
Boots. Even.
If you do a get together in summer or something, I'll come along and I'll wear my Cavalli jeans and my Jimmy Choo boots.
That'll be for the thousandth episode get together, massive party.
So that was a dad thing. That was a dad joke. I shouldn't say things like that.
Nice.
I'm so old. I'm so embarrassed about myself.
I've
got to turn up and I wear my boots.
Nice. Please wear other stuff as well, yeah? So, just make sure you do. It is a family podcast after all.
Okay, fair enough. I'll wear some more stuff.
Brilliant. Anyway, look, thank you very much indeed, Ralph, as always. Lots of fun. Interesting topics. You know, and here we are. I mean, we're just at the end of January, but there's still loads of stuff going on. So anyway, we'll be back again discussing more. And thank you very much for your time. So have
as always,
lovely
pleasure to be here. Thank you guys for listening.
Alrighty. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.